Now, it's my pleasure to introduce the first guest lecturer in the PEONL series, Professor Drew Henry. And what he's going to tell us about is, or how to do, is build up our understanding of how a cell does what it does by describing in basic terms that cellular processes are the result of following algorithms. And he's going to give us examples of some of these, and then tell you, once you understand what some of these algorithms are, how you can use it to do interesting biology.
Thanks, Paul. Morning. As Paul just said, I'm going to talk about two things, right? First thing I'm going to talk about today is the ideas that cells themselves do computation and how this might be interesting to you as a scientist or an engineer thinking about biology and getting a better handle on what biological systems do. I hope to dispense with that in maybe 15 minutes or something like that. But I'm hoping also that you're going to hammer me with some questions, because it should become apparent pretty soon into my lecture that I don't have a perfect understanding of what's going on in biology, either from the standpoint of science or from the standpoint of engineering. And so we'll see how that goes. Second part of what I want to talk about today is using that knowledge and understanding of biology as a science to then turn it around and really go design and build or engineer new biological systems. This gets called a bunch of different things. Most recently, and you know, these days it's called synthetic biology. You've got a little comic strip that can provide some background introduction. So again, two topics: how do biological systems compute, how might you think about that, and then given an understanding of biology, how would you start to go engineer living systems? Does that sound okay? All right. So what do we mean by compute? What's compute? What's computing? Anybody have a good definition they want to roll out? Anybody use a computer? Somebody in the back there, you've got a computer. What's that thing do?
Compute.
What's that?
Compute.
Okay, so how does it compute? What happens when it computes? Are you doing anything different than what these fellows here are doing?
Probably in some fashion, they're not. I mean, basically, no.
Are they like checking email or something like that?
Uh-huh.
But what is it about the computer that lets it compute? What's going on there? Okay. And then are you part of the equation of computing? Are you doing anything with the computer that helps it compute? You got some input? Okay, so you're giving that machine some information, right? So you're defining the environment around that machine. Then you mentioned the CPU, something inside that box, which is taking that information and what? Yeah, you don't have to tell us what you're doing, right? So you don't need to reveal any secrets. But it's taking that information and processing it, right? And then depending on what it does, then what? It processes the information and you never see anything, or the stuff on the screen changes, or your computer makes some output. Okay, so that's not a bad working definition, right? So you could think, what's computation? We've got a machine, in this case a laptop, in this case an earlier computer. Oh, nice to come in this morning, Brian. How are you? So you've got this thing. It's taking an input. Your laptop's taking an input. It's doing some processing on the information. It's computing. And then as it takes the results of those computations and does something, actuates something, right? Displays something on the screen, causes the blinds to go up and down if they were, you know, and so on. So this is fine for computers, and we're familiar with that, right? Computers compute, right? It's built into the definition of the word. What I want to do is I want to zoom out a little bit and give you an abstract framework for thinking about how biological systems compute. So we just talked about, if you have this idea of a machine, information is going to come in from the environment into the machine, and something's going to happen, right? Or not. It depends on how the computer's programmed. And then that information will eventually go away. Maybe there'll be action, maybe there won't, right? But as a general framework for thinking about computing, you have information coming into the machine and information leaving, right? And the thing that's interesting about computing is you end up doing computing over time, right? It's not like computing happens instantaneously. It's the information comes in, takes some time, you do some computing, and then something happens. And so what we're going to need to think about if we want to understand how computing works in biology is map this framework across different lengths of time. And this sounds abstract, but I'll bring it back to something pretty simple in a second. So the first time scale I want you to start thinking about is this idea of short time scale performance, right? That one form of computing is just take in some information and do something, right? So for example, if you've got a cell phone, an example of short time scale computing would, I'd dial up Paul, right, his phone, and I'd hit enter, and I'd call him up, right? So I'd be taking some information, putting it into the machine would be taking some action, right? A cell might respond to a signal its environment, something it wants to eat, right, and change how it's swimming, you know, start moving faster or slower. The next time scale to think about in terms of computing is a medium time scale, right, where you're still taking information in from the environment and you're processing that information, but you might be adapting your behavior, changing what you're doing. You might be learning something, right? So in the context of the cell phone, I could program in Paul's number, I could store it, I could speak his name, and then I could have voice-activated calling, right? And this machine, having received this information, would change its behavior, right? So that in the future, when I was interacting with it again, it would behave differently. You're all biological systems, right? You might learn, oh, I like the burritos at, Anna's, and so over time, you're going to keep going back there, or I'll speak for myself, I'll keep going back there, right? So there's information processing in biological systems on different time scales. So let's dive in a little bit and look quickly at two examples of short time scale information processing in living systems. How many people know what bacteria are? Okay, so bacteria are these little critters, right? They're about a micron long, and they live all around, and they do stuff, right? They make copies of themselves, they swim around and whatnot. So this is a movie from Scientific American's website made by a fellow, Jeff Johnson. And what this is not a movie of an actual bacteria. This is a cartoon, computer animation. And what Jeff's trying to depict here is this process by which bacteria are somehow swimming through space, right? You sort of admire the computer rendering of this. But in the context of what we're talking about, the thing I want you to consider is, what sort of computing is this bacterium doing, right? What do you think about it? What is it? What do you see the bacteria? What's the bacterium doing? It's propelling itself. And does it look like it's just moving around randomly, or is it going somewhere? It's going in a straight line. So that means it must be finding something that it likes, or going for a walk, or running away from something that's trying to eat it, or something, right? So you can, this is a made-up image, right? So we can just make up explanations for the sorts of information processing going on. But you can begin to imagine that information is coming in from the environment, that somehow this bacterium is receiving that information, processing it, right, in a way that's different than the microprocessor in the laptop back there. And then actuating the behavior of the system, right? In this case, causing these little hair-like things to, go back and forth in some cascade reaction. So there's a couple problems I want you to think about in the context of this example. And this is where biological engineering comes into the fore, right? Because it turns out that this animation is so deeply messed up from the standpoint of reality, that if you were to think about information processing in the context of the stories we were just talking about, you wouldn't get very far. So what are some of the, can anybody think of some problems with this movie, right? If you were the executive producer of this movie, and somebody showed up with this animation, oh, check it out, this is how bacteria swim, you'd go, huh. I don't like it because of the following. Anybody think of some reasons why this might not be a good depiction of bacterium swimming? So you were mentioning before when you were looking at this that they're swimming in a straight line. Is that easy or hard to do? Why would you think it'd be hard? Can you walk in a straight line? I can walk in a straight line. Oh, I can see. So there's no eyes on the bacteria. And I don't know what sort of sensors there are. So if I had my eyes closed, it would be harder for me to walk in a straight line. Is that right? Well, I don't know about that. Has anybody tried to walk down the infinite corridor with your eyes closed? I don't know. I don't know how hard it would be. But you said something about sensors too. So you need some way of getting the information in. So let's say that there's sensors all over the surface of the bacteria, and they're just too small, so we can't see them. Would you be happy then that you could go in a straight line? Okay, let's say there's one sensor here, and there's another sensor back here, at the bow and the stern. Would that let you go in a straight line? What does somebody else think? What would you do if you had information coming in? If you had a ship, right, and you're trying to go in a straight line, and you had a sensor at the front of the ship and a sensor at the back of the ship, could you go in a straight line if you were sensing something in the environment? What would those two inputs let you do? So if you had something in the environment and you wanted to, say, run away from something, there might be more of it behind you than there is in front of you, right? And so you could go, huh, there's more back there, so let's keep going this way. Maybe that would work, right? So you could use the sensor in the back and the sensor in the front to establish a gradient or directionality of a signal in the environment and then do some computing using the molecules of the cell to make a decision about which direction to go. So, okay. Maybe that's a pretty good idea, right? We're beginning to develop some model for how the information inside in the environment around this cell might establish some useful framework for the cell to do computing to control its behavior. Anybody see a problem with that model? How big is this cell? How big are bacteria? Are they like meter long? Do you run into bacterium in your, you know, in between classes, you sort of get out of the way? So it turns out bacterium are really tiny, right? They're a micron, approximately, long. And so even if you put a sensor here and here, if this is only a micron long, the thing you're sensing is going to be freely diffusing in the environment around you, right? Which means that you might not be long enough to actually measure the gradient. You're not going to be able to sense it. There's another problem with this movie, right? The artist here, it's a brilliant piece of work, but the artist hasn't captured the physical framework correctly around the bacteria. There's no eyes, so how are you going to walk in a straight line? You're not long enough, so you can't actually set up a gradient directly. The other thing is, because they're so small, there's going to be water molecules buffeting this bacteria randomly, Brownian motion, right? And so even if you could start off in a straight line, I want to go over here, things are going to be bumping into the cell, and you're going to randomly lose the direction you were going in. And so you're going to have to recompute over and over again. I want to be going that way. I want to be going that way. I want to be so it's a weird physical system, right? I'm not going to go through any more details of this, but if you want to start thinking about computing in biology, you need to imagine what's the information in the environment around the cell, what's the physical framework by which that information is going to make it into the cell, how might the cell do the computing, and then decide what to do, right? And so you can start to imagine how physics and mathematics come together in biological engineering to develop the frameworks by which you don't just understand the molecules that make up living systems, you understand how all these molecules come together to control the behavior of living systems. So let me show you real quick a movie of actual bacteria swimming. This comes from Howard Berg's work. Howard's in biology at Harvard, as well as physics. So what you're looking at here are E. coli swimming around. You can see they really truck, right? They're quite impressive little critters. But if you look at it, you'll see, whoa, you know, what are they doing? They're not going in straight lines, for one, right? You just follow some. Let's see, let the movie reset here. see these cells? They're sort of like, whoa, right? Or check it out. They're just looping around. They can't go in a straight line, right? They're trying to figure out how to go somewhere. And you know, sometimes they just like spin around and stuff like that. And if you look at them a little more closely, in this movie, you start to see that that flagella, those things that were hanging behind them, are doing all sorts of weird stuff, right? Sometimes they're going in a straight line, spinning all together. Sometimes they start spinning in the other direction, they splay out, and the whole cell spins around. It turns out that what these bacteria are going to do is they're going to alternate between swimming in a straight line as best they can, which isn't that good, and then they're going to sometimes tumble randomly. And they're just going to alternate between doing that back and forth, swimming, tumbling, swimming, tumbling. And they're going to change the length of the runs, how long they go in a straight line as best they can, in proportion to whether or not they believe they're going in the right direction. So to say it differently, bacteria might start out swimming. It'll remember what the concentration of something was here. And then it'll move, and it'll say, oh, is it getting better or worse? And if it's getting worse, maybe you'll tumble and just try another random direction. And if it's getting better, you'll just keep going in that direction a little bit longer. But then eventually, you have to tumble again. And you'll try randomly sampling a new direction. So it's a random walk that the bacterium end up using in order to go up or down a gradient of something they like, right? Interesting information processing problem. Here's another one, not from bacterium, but this time from you. So this is a picture of a white blood cell in a field of red blood cells. And this is a little bacterium that the white blood cell would like to hunt down and destroy to keep you from getting sick, right? So check this movie out and think about the information processing that's going on here. Notice that it locked onto this one. It didn't pay any attention to this one. How'd it do that? Is the bacterium running away, do you think? Or is it being pushed away by the boundary layer of fluid as the white blood cell chases it? What's the right physics? How does the cell do this computation, right? Imagine you were trying to program a missile, right, to follow a plane. The computation you'd have to do, find the target, change your trajectory. All of that's going on here in this white blood cell, right? All of this is happening inside you whenever you're infected. Pretty cool problem, right? I think this is real time. I can't remember. It's a very old movie, actually. It's a 16-millimeter film from 1950-something. You should be able to estimate whether it's real time or not by the apparent tumbling rate of the bacterium and Brownian motion, right? Pretty impressive computation. So those are examples of physical performance, right? You just got to take in a signal and do something, right? Or medium time scale performance, you know, learning. Am I going in the right direction? Is this a bacterium I want to hunt down and destroy, right? And so you can start to think about computing in biology. Although the thing to say about biology, in addition to these two examples, that makes it incredibly cool is that biology does computing on an additional time scale. And you don't see this time scale in any other physical artifact that you engineer. This additional time scale is the long time scale, the time scale of evolution, right? So evolution is this process, as you would have heard previously, right? Biological systems, via a replication of the DNA and replication of the organism, can make copies, right? Parent to child and so on. Now, what's cool about biology is when biological systems copy themselves, they make mistakes, right? They're mutations in the copying process. And so over long time scales and with big populations, the machine itself can change. Information will come in the form of selection presented by the environment, right? It's good to be tall or short in the next 100 years. Who knows? And over time, those mutations will be fixed into the machine, defining and changing the machine itself. And you can view the process of evolution as a process of computation. Here's an example. This is a depiction of part of the human chromosome. This is a region of the human chromosome found in males. It's the male-specific Y region. This sequence of the human chromosome was figured out by David Page's group at the Whitehead across the parking lot there. Now, the thing about the Y chromosome is that the architecture of it, from the standpoint of speaking as an engineer, not as a scientist, the architecture of this is really messed up, right? Which may or may not be surprising to you if you think about stuff. So what I mean by that is you've got about 5 million base pairs of DNA, right? DNA is the genetic material, and A's, T's, C's, and G's, those are the base pairs. So you've got about 5 million base pairs of DNA on the screen here. This region of DNA in yellow, about 800,000 base pairs, is exactly the same as this region, almost exactly the same, except it's in the opposite orientation. So I've got an element over here, and I've got a repeated element over here. Similarly, this region, B4, is like this, and these regions here, and so on and so on. So I've got an architecture of inverted repeats that are nested. Now, it turns out that there's a couple different models for why the Y chromosome might have this architecture. One reason is the thing about the Y, unlike the male-specific region of the Y, is that there's not a complementary copy of this region of DNA on another chromosome, on the X, right? And because there's no backup copy on another chromosome, the argument goes that the Y needs to be carrying two copies of its DNA on itself, so that on evolutionary timescale, it can swap in copies for one another as a way of getting rid of mistakes, right? So if there's a mistake over here, maybe if I'm lucky, I can swap this piece back in and replace it. So the Y is carrying a backup copy of itself in perhaps parts of this. And so you could go, huh, I wonder if other Y chromosomes are doing that, right? So here's a paper that came out from Japan last month, where they were looking at the Y chromosome of the chimp, which is shown down here. And then this is another depiction of what we were just looking at, the human. And then you can estimate what the common ancestral Y was. And then you can estimate what the earlier ancestor was, right? So you can start to think about this problem of replication of a machine on evolutionary timescales, mutation and selection impacting the processing of that information, the computation. And then, as a scientist or an engineer, developing a framework that would let you go from the things you see today, right? This is what the human Y looks like. This is what the chimp Y looks like. I wonder what the ancestor looked like. I wonder what the thing before that looked like, right? How would you start to think about that stuff? So biological systems are interesting computing machines. They compute on short time scale. They answer phone calls. They say, I want to eat that thing. They process information on medium time scales, right? They learn stuff. They forget things. They change their behavior. And then they process information on evolutionary time scales, right? So at the intersection of science and engineering, you find a whole bunch of interesting computation to figure out and to do, right? So in this triangle that I think is a theme through the class, sort of operating down here, along the edge between science and engineering. So that's a quick introduction to computational biology from the perspective of what sort of computing are biological systems themselves doing. Anybody have any thoughts or questions about that? Everybody buy the 3 time scales of information processing for biological systems, or are there 5? Did I forget to? Don't know, right? Still trying to figure this out myself. So if you pursue a career in biological engineering, there's a lot of good contributions to be made. So I want to switch gears and just imagine what the world's like in the context of, well, yeah, living systems exist in nature, and we got to figure them out. But there's another thing you could do, right? You could start to engineer biological systems directly. So that's what I'm going to switch gears and talk about for the next 20 minutes or so. And to put this in perspective as best I can from the 40,000 foot view, I want to make the argument that there's 3 relationships that human beings can have with the living world. Okay? The first relationship goes all the way back, you know, before Darwin, hundreds of years ago, where people think that living systems exist and they don't change. And that's what everybody believed. There was a scientific revolution, a transition here, where Darwin and colleagues come along, they figure out the process of evolution, they go, biological systems exist, all right, they come from nature, but they change, and they change via this process of reproduction with error and selection, via evolution. And here's the third relationship you can have with the living world. This is a technical transition. Biological systems exist in the natural living world, sure, they change via evolution, but oh, by the way, we can make new ones, and I'll show you how to do that. And we can make them via a design process that may approach rational. I won't go into this one right now. And this is a transition which is driven by technology. It's not a scientific transition. It's just, can we do it or not? And it's one that's started up about 30 years ago when it became possible to directly edit DNA. And it's, you know, as you can imagine, right, the first day of class at MIT with course 20 as a course number, starting to happen ever more quickly. Here's a quick example. This is a depiction of the genome of a virus that I've studied for the last 12 years ago or so. It's a virus that infects bacterium and just destroys them. And there's a bunch of genes and regulatory elements, and let's not go into all the details. One of the things we do is we make computational models of the infection process. So what you're looking at here is gene expression as the virus is infecting a bacterium, RNA polymerase molecules reading out the DNA, proteins and stuff getting made. This is the best computer simulation we've got for gene expression inside bacteria. We can track individual molecules of RNA polymerase with single base pair resolution on the DNA, blah, 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 right? Run it on the computer, get all this numbers and stuff. It's a simulation, right? You can run it backwards, and we can use this to study the infection process of the virus. Without going into the details, let me simply declare that this computer model is woefully insufficient to predict how the virus is going to behave when we change it or when it evolves. So even though this is an incredibly powerful tool, we've run into lots of problems as we try and make the mapping between the computer models of how the biological system will behave and the actual physical performance in the lab. And if you think about it from the standpoint of engineering, why the models aren't quite good enough in biology, there's some interesting conclusions you can come to. The most interesting one for me as an engineer is that biology itself is not optimized by nature to be easy to model, because nature doesn't care about that. Let me give you some examples. This is the list of genes that make up the virus. There are about 60 genes. The ones that are highlighted in this color, those are the ones for which we don't know anything about those genes. About 40% of the genes. So that's sort of like, oh, and oh, by the way, it's not just me because I'm stupid. It's which is true. But it's nobody on the planet knows what these genes do. Right? So it's sort of like you open up the hood of your car, and you go, what's that? Don't know. With your car, you can go talk to the mechanic or the person who made the car, right? And somebody on the planet knows. In this case, I open up the hood on the genome of this virus. And about 40% of the things, nobody knows what they do. So how am I going to model or understand or engineer a system where 40% of the components are completely mysterious to me? Maybe I can do it, but it's going to be a trick. That's a problem. I'm going to declare, from the standpoint of engineering, I'm going to declare that to be unsatisfying about biology. Where do all these things come from? Don't know. Here's a second problem. Let's look at the DNA sequence just for a sec. You know, if you're programming a computer, sometimes you might want to think about zeros and ones, right? So here we're looking at the A's, G's, C's, and T's. So here's a stretch of virus DNA, and there's a region right here that comes in from the left and stops. And that encodes this protein, 2.8, right? Don't worry about these details, just grok the big picture. Right? Here's another gene, 3. It starts at this green sequence, ATG, and goes off to the right. So what's curious about the real estate on this virus's genome is that the two coding regions, the two genes, overlap, right? They share real estate. And it's not like a timeshare condo. I mean, they physically share. They occupy the same space on the DNA. I have no idea what's going on here. Is this some important functional coupling that controls the reading out of the genetic information? Maybe. It's a big problem. It's just as bad as having an unknown part, this coupling. The other problem is, if I want to change this, right, to test a prediction, I can't change gene 3 in this region without also changing gene 2.8. I can't independently manipulate one thing, right? So it would be like, you know, I make a phone call here and my computer crashes, right? Or you increase the volume of your radio in your car and the steering wheel starts to move, right? You've got coupling of components. Here's a depiction of, so the question I want to pose to you is why? Why might the systems look like that? So here's a depiction of an electrical circuit. Is anybody taking 6001 or 6002 or stuff like that? It meets right now, so you can't take. Okay, so this is your surrogate for 6002, right? So this is a schema of an electrical circuit, and I can assure you that nobody in 6002 can explain to you how this circuit works. You want to know why? Why do you think that is? Turns out that this circuit wasn't designed by a human being. It was designed by an evolutionary computer program, right? So you can simulate evolution on a computer, and you can simulate electrical circuits well enough that you can actually evolve electrical circuits to do stuff, right? So this is a circuit that came out of an evolutionary program. And the design of this circuit is supposed to produce something that takes the square root of an input voltage. That's it. And when I go talk to Jerry Sussman in course 6, who's a great friend, I say, Jerry, how does this work? He goes, he doesn't say, I don't know. He goes, I refuse to work on the problem. It's not, what? Right? I refuse to work on the problem of figuring out how this works because it wasn't designed for it to be easy for me to figure out how it works. What if biological systems are like that? Does that mean he won't try and figure out how biological systems work? Well, maybe he can't do the same thing unless he has the option of building biological systems, right? So I'll switch over that. So for example, instead of accepting this piece of DNA from nature, maybe I can replace it with this piece of DNA, which is an engineered surrogate, a replacement, where I take the gene for 3 and I put it over here. I take this control element for 3, which I didn't talk about, and I put it over here. And I add in some insulation to separate the parts out. I just give it a try. Who knows if it'll work or not? So I could take an entire section of the genome with bunches of overlapping elements, right? And I could run it through a decompression, an unstuffing, an editing algorithm. And I could redesign the entire genome of a virus. And then I could build it. Construct the pieces of DNA. And I could put it back into cells and see if it grows or not. Right? So we've done that in the lab over the last couple years for the virus we study. These are holes in a lawn of bacteria. This is a 10-centimeter Petri dish with a lawn, an opaque lawn of bacteria, and then you place the virus in the middle of these circles, and then over time the virus grows and destroys the bacteria and leaves what's called a plaque, an empty hole in the lawn of bacteria. And this is what the virus isolated from nature 60 years ago does to the bacteria. It makes nice big circular plaques. And then this is what the engineered virus does. It makes nice small plaques. It doesn't grow as well. It doesn't grow as quickly. But it grows. So we can take the genome of a natural biological system and redesign it so that it's easier for us to think about. We can separate out overlapping parts and so on and so forth. So which of these organisms do you think is more fit? What do you think? The one on the left from nature or the one on the right that we engineered? Which one's going to survive? Which one? Survival of the fittest, right? Like Survivor. What's that game show? What's that? Reality show, Survivor?
Yeah.
The one on the left. Does everybody agree? Yeah.
Well, it depends on if you're trying to keep a lot of viruses alive, they're going to eat off bacteria on the left or the right. So what do you mean by fit?
That's a good question. So to answer the question of what you mean by, you know, which one's more fit, you have to define what the environment is that they're growing in, right? So if we're always going to add bacteria, then maybe it's the one on the left, right? If we're always going to make more of this virus whenever we want it, because we can, then maybe this one's more fit, right? Depends. Here's another paper that came out recently. This came out from Mitsubishi in Japan. This group, it came out a couple months ago. What they did was they took the genome of one bacterium, Senecia cystis, about 3.5 million base pairs long, and they moved it into the genome of another bacteria, Bacillus subtilis, combining two genomes into one cell. Got it? So now I've got a new cell. It's got two genomes inside it, one from Senecia cystis, a marine bacterium, and then the other from B. subtilis. Right. So in the previous slides, I showed you that we can do fine-grained editing of genetic elements to redesign a genome. And here, there's a group in Japan that's moving millions of base pairs of DNA around, combining two genomes into one cell, making something that's 7.7 million base pairs long. Remember this picture? This is a depiction of the male-specific region of the human Y chromosome that's 5 million base pairs long. It's physically possible to construct a fragment of DNA this big today. What if you wanted to engineer it? What would you do? Should you do it? As soon as you start to think about engineering biology, not only do you run into a lot of interesting technical questions, but you should start to imagine that there's some very obvious and direct social questions, right? It's technically possible to pull off engineering of things like this today. The reason that this is becoming ever more possible isn't just because we're learning science, ever more science about biology, because we're developing technologies that help us to engineer biological systems. And so here's one I want to highlight quickly before wrapping up. So there's this technology. Everybody knows what DNA is, right? DNA is genetic material. Does anybody know what DNA sequencing is? What's DNA sequencing? Okay, so reading it out. So if you have a physical copy of the genetic material, you use DNA sequencing to read out the information. There's another technology called DNA synthesis. What do you think DNA synthesis is? Yeah. So if you start with the information, you use DNA synthesis to make the material. Got it? So sequencing is reading out of DNA from physical material to information. Synthesis is the writing of DNA from information and raw materials to physical DNA molecules. So these bottles here are bottles of reagents that you plug into a DNA synthesizer. This is a bottle of A. There's 10 grams of A. This is a bottle of G, C, and T. Here are the bottles. Don't drop. So the stuff in this bottle comes from sugarcane and is processed to make it suitable for plugging into the DNA synthesizer. So you take this machine, you plug these bottles in, and you start to feed in a sequence of information, and out comes a molecule of DNA. It's a pretty cool technology, right? If you watch Star Trek, it's like having a matter compiler for genetic material, right? Out comes DNA, right? They're not as sophisticated as the things you see on the TV shows, but they're getting better. Yeah. Correct. So the DNA synthesizer, right? Synthesizer. It's a box. You feed in the raw materials, and you feed in the information. There's no template, right? The template is the information, and out comes the molecules of DNA. Make sense? So it's a bunch of synthetic chemistry that's absolutely beautiful. It's mostly finished by 1982. And I don't want to go into the details of that right now, but if you shoot me an email, just my last name, I'll send you a link to the process of synthesis. Okay. Here's something to think about. How good are we getting at synthesis, right? Because if it's really easy to make DNA, then we're going to be programming DNA out the wazoo, and if it's really hard, we're not. This is Moore's law, features per chip on microprocessors, right? Doubling every 18 months. This is DNA sequencing, reading out of DNA. Wasn't doing so well until about 1990, and then it really went off. And that led to things like the Human Genome Project, reading out of our own genetic material. Here's synthesis. It's coming up about 5 to 7 years later, as fast as sequencing did, right? So it's not that good yet. The price of synthesizing a gene, something 1,000 base pairs long, is still about $1 a base pair, right? So if you wanted a 2,000 base pair gene, you'd be deciding between, do I really want to synthesize this gene, or do I want a new laptop, right? It turns out that the price of synthesizing genes has dropped by a factor of 2 each of the last 4 years. Right, so when I moved to MIT, the price was about $10 to $15 a base pair. And I bet the price drops by a factor of 2 each year before you graduate. So it'll be around 10 cents maybe by the time you graduate. That's going to be pretty interesting to biological engineering, right? Because it means that if you want a piece of DNA, maybe you're just going to start synthesizing it. And you're going to end up living through that transition, I suspect. Here are some, if you go onto Google and just type gene synthesis and then look where the companies are, here are some companies from around the world that do gene synthesis. It's not a technology that's particularly sophisticated, and so you could set up your own gene synthesis, right, operation wherever you want. I'll try this to see if this works. There you go. So these aren't very good, right? But for about $1,500, you get an old DNA synthesizer, start making DNA, right? You'd be able to make small pieces, take you a long time, wouldn't be cost effective, but it's not a super sophisticated technology. So here's the challenge that DNA synthesis is going to pose to biological engineering. You can write DNA. What do you want to say? How are you going to program a living system to do something useful, right? How would I program bacteria not to swim around randomly, but to make this pattern over time? How am I going to program bacteria to make a high concentration of an important drug molecule, drug precursor? How am I going to program a plant to sense something in the environment and change color? Or how am I going to program another living organism to assemble a calcite lens to do optical processing, right? Don't know. I'm going to be able to write lots and lots of DNA, but I have no idea how to design and build useful biological systems in any way that approaches what a mature engineering discipline would look like. Right? If you think about the Stata Center, Building 32 that went up, it's an amazing building, but it wasn't a research project. It was a construction project. Right? And it did come in over budget, but it didn't come in over budget by a factor of 20. Right? It came in over budget by like a factor of 3 or something like that. And it came in mostly on time. And this building here, it's not a research project. When this building got made, it was done, right? But if we go and try and program biological systems, the state of biological engineering today is such that we're over here doing research projects. And so the work in synthetic biology, in the engineering of biology, is to figure out how to make the process stop being like this and look something that looks more as such, where if you want to quickly produce a living system that does something useful. You can design it, you can build it, you can build your systems from things called parts that get used over and over again to quickly produce something. We don't know how to do this. It's where the frontline research is in biological engineering. I'll give you an example for how lame we are, speaking of myself, right? So So in 1864, this fellow, William Sellars, gave a talk at the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia. And he made the following argument. In the United States, it would be good if we had a standard system for screw threads. Anybody ever think about that? That we have a standard system for screw threads? I hadn't thought about this until like 3 years ago. I've been living my entire life making good use of standard screw threads. But it turns out that apparently in March of 1864, the United States did not have a system of standards for screw threads. Think about the consequences of that. That means that if you buy a mechanical object in March of 1864 from Joe Bob's machine shop and it breaks, you have to go back to that machine shop to get it fixed because the screws in that machine are going to be specific to the tooling that was used to produce them in that machine shop, right? So Sellars shows up and goes, ah, we got to stop this. We're going to have screw threads that are 60 degrees on a side and squared off at the top. That's it. This is what the British had done a couple decades before, the Whitworth standard. That was 55 degrees on a side and rounded, which is a nice screw thread. It's a standard, but it's very hard to set up a machine to make a 55-degree angle, right? So Sellars in the US said, no, no, we're going 60 degrees. And oh, by the way, Sellars had also retooled all of the machines, apparently, in his machine shops to make this standard, so that when he gave this big paper at the Franklin Institute, his factories were already set up to supply, you know, so it's a smart guy. What's the equivalent of a standard screw thread in biological engineering? Maybe it's how we put pieces of DNA together, right? Maybe we need standards for how proteins bind DNA. Maybe we need standards for gene expression. Don't know. Got to figure it out. But the fact of the matter is, you exist in a world right now in biological engineering where there's no such thing like a standard screw thread. And so the engineering of biological systems is more of an art, right, than a reliable engineering discipline. And some of the work, if you pursue the field, is going to be to figure out how to contribute to a foundational technology set that helps make engineering and biology easier. There's some of this, I should say a lot of this, happening at MIT, right? So if you go to the parts.mit.edu website, you can find a nascent registry of standard biological parts. Although, to be honest, we really have no idea what these things mean, what the idea of a standard part means yet, excuse me. I want to close quickly by showing some of the work that students are doing in biological engineering as they help us figure out how to engineer biological systems. So these are students from five schools in the summer of 2004 who are working to design and build biological systems, right? So there's a team from Caltech and Texas and MIT and Boston University and Princeton. The team from Texas, they worked with some friends from UCSF, San Francisco, and they wanted to program bacteria to act as photographic film. So you're going to spread bacteria out on a surface and then shine an image onto the bacterium, the lawn of bacterium, and the bacterium are going to change color and take a picture. Pretty easy, right? If you're going to be biological engineers, you should be able to program bacteria to take a picture, right? It's a toy problem. That's what they wanted to do over their summer. They said, well, we're going to think about this in a black box. We're going to make a receiver. The receiver takes in light. The light gets converted to a signal via some computation. This signal comes into another device that makes color. So we just found these, if we want to make this biofilm, right, we need to figure out how to make these two devices. And so we're going to make these devices out of parts. This one has two parts, and this one has three parts. And if you go back to that registry website, parts.mit.edu, you type these numbers in, you can see what the DNA sequence is for each of these parts. Now you make up this molecule of DNA based on these parts and you put it into bacterium, you grow up the bacterium, you spread it out on a table, you start taking pictures. Here's the first picture they were taking, right? This isn't sophisticated equipment, right? Here's their incubator and here's their casserole dish, which is controlling the humidity. And that's the first picture they take. This is a 10 by 10 centimeter lawn of bacteria, and it's spelling out this text image. And then they get a little bit better with their cameras, and here's a next generation picture they took. So this is, again, a 10 by 10 centimeter lawn of bacteria. This is a picture of Andy Ellington, who's a professor of biochemistry down at UT Austin, right? And he's now got his E. coli photograph taken. Not too bad, right? you can start to put things together to do novel, interesting stuff. Remember that bacterium are really small. They're only a micron, which means that in a square inch on this dish, you're going to have a billion of them, right? Which means that this film is gigapixel per square inch, right? So you can start to program the individual bacterium with light, get them to change directions, produce colors, make metabolites, excrete things that might help you make materials, right, in a lithographic process. So every summer, it turns out that a bunch of students in biological engineering, not just at MIT, but for example, last summer, 13 schools around the world compete with one another to build engineered biological systems. Right, so here's the team from ETH in Zurich last summer. This is outside Stata Center. They came here to present their work. Here's the team from Cambridge, England. Here are two of the folks on the team from MIT. If this is the sort of thing you're interested in, you might explore biological engineering, right? In the BE 109 lab, the course 2109 lab, this semester, we're actually extending this bacterial photography system, trying to make it two-color, right? How would you do that? So if I come back to this to end, right, we started out by talking about computation in biology, right, and how if you think about the physical problems that biological systems have to solve, the information they receive from the environment, the computations they have to do, you can develop a framework by which to understand them. And engineering has a lot to add to that, right? You need to think about the physics, you need to think about the mathematics, the control of the system, and so on. If you take those two things together and start to apply it, you can imagine designing and building useful biological systems, and that leads up to the top, right, biotechnology, right? And obviously, to close, I would simply also urge you to think outside the triangle, because nobody's quite sure where biological engineering is going to go, but it's definitely got a lot of interesting directions to explore. Thanks very much for your attention. If there's questions, I got a little bit of time afterwards. If you've got time, otherwise, you can shoot me an email, and thanks.